My name is Doris Meissner. I'm a senior fellow and director of U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute, and I'll be serving as moderator for this first of the panel discussions of the day. And as Andy said in welcoming you, it's quite a chock-full day with lots of topics and lots of very good speakers. So we're delighted that you're here with us, and I think we're all as interested to hear the program as we are to participate in the program. Now, as your program says, and as Dimitri said in the introductions, our topic for this panel is the devolution of immigration authority, the role of states in immigration enforcement and policymaking. And to discuss that, we have an outstanding group. On my right is Terry Goddard, who has served as the Attorney General of the state of Arizona for two terms, ending in 2010. And that was preceded by a very long career in public service of a variety of different roles, including having served as mayor of Phoenix for 6 years. Also with us is somebody we know well, Tamar Jacoby, who is the president and CEO of Immigration Works USA, a national federation of small business owners who are working to advance better immigration laws. She's also a nationally known journalist and author and somebody who has been indefatigable on these issues. And so it's very nice to have you be with us, Tamar. And then finally, of course, Mark Shurtleff, who has been introduced already and whom you've already met. Suffice to say, I welcome your joining our panel also. And as Dimitri said at the beginning, we'll allow you to ask questions of all of us, including Mark, at the close of the panel. Now, we're going to try to do this in a slightly conversational mode, and I'm going to pose questions of each of the panelists to get us started, and hopefully that will generate some follow-up questions and some crosstalk among us. But let me first try to set the stage here in terms of the issues. The issue of devolution as an element of immigration policy is, in fact, a new phenomenon. We all know the familiar phrase that nature abhors a vacuum. Mark made reference to this in his comments. We've had a vacuum in that there's been an absence of federal action for now many years on an issue that is of increasing urgency and concern to publics all across the nation. And that has led states to step in to a province that has been throughout our history the exclusive realm of the federal government. So we are in a new place where immigration is concerned and where the role of states are concerned. Dimitri gave some of the data. Let me update it with the most recent legislative session, the first quarter of this calendar year, 2011. Through the end of March, which is when most state legislatures are their busiest, more than 1,700 immigration or immigration-related bills have been introduced in all 50 states and in Puerto Rico. In contrast, only 6 years ago, in 2005, there were only 300 measures introduced in legislatures. So from 300 to 1,700 just gives you some sense of what the arc here has been. Those measures, those 1,700 measures that were introduced in these last months, are basically divided into two groups of measures. And the source for all of this, of course, is the National Conference on State Legislatures, which keeps the most complete and best records on these issues. The basic groups in which you divide those 1,700 measures is into targeted measures and omnibus measures. The vast majority of them are targeted measures. They deal with a specific thing, such as driver's licenses, a particular program, state program eligibility, something like that. It's the omnibus bills, of which there are far, far fewer, that we're interested in this topic of devolution. It's the omnibus bills that are the ones that sweep across many domains and that have substantial impacts on states and on the lives of people who live in our communities. Those omnibus bills number far, far fewer than the 1,700. In this first quarter of this year, there were 52 omnibus measures introduced in 30 states. only two of them actually passed and were signed, and those were the bills in Utah. The third has been passed in Georgia and has not yet been signed, but all signs indicate that, in fact, it will be signed. So we've had three out of the 52 that have been enacted or likely to be enacted. None of the others passed in this calendar year. So what we're talking about here are issues and developments that have actually happened in just a few places in the country. But at the same time, they represent a very significant break with our past, and they raise a series of important new questions for immigration law and practice. So, with that as the backdrop for what we're talking about, let me go first to Terry Goddard, who has labored in this vineyard for some while, and ask him the question, several questions about the Arizona experience. Arizona, of course, has been at the epicenter of the devolution issue, having passed SB 1070 last year, and of course we all know about the federal lawsuit to block it that is wending its way through the courts. So although the key pieces of that SB 1070 law are on hold until we find out what happens to the case, Terry, talk to us about what the indirect effects have been in Arizona from the passage of SB 1070. Has the recent Ninth Circuit decision changed things in any way? And what do you think accounts for 1070 having passed last year and other measures by the same sponsors having been brought up in this legislative session not having passed?
Okay. Thank you. Let me thank the conference for recognizing that there has been a huge shift and that state government, state legislatures, state law enforcement officials are, at least for the moment, at where the debate on immigration is taking place. And I think this conference comes at a very, very good time. The indirect impact of Senate Bill 1070, Doris, you're kind to say I labored in the vineyard. I think perhaps I was one of the first casualties of the vineyard. Had it not been for Senate Bill 1070, I would be addressing you today as governor of Arizona, not just as a former attorney general. So that's a personal note. There's much more. But my general election opponent, the now governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, at the time, a year ago, that she signed Senate Bill 1070, was running third in a field of four Republicans. And my probable opponent as the Democratic nominee was going to be a guy named Buzz Mills, a name that is perhaps lost in history, but who looked like he was the odds-on favorite to win the Republican nomination. Everything changed a year ago when 1070 was signed. And there's tremendous power, as Mark has referred to, I think, very appropriately, in the images that have been conveyed by the advocates and the power that swept through Arizona, and you've seen in the 1,700 bills that have been introduced around the country. This is the time for reflection. 1 year later, I guess that anniversary is particularly appropriate. The Arizona Republic editorialized on the one-year anniversary that a year later, Senate Bill 1070 looks like a big, expensive con. It brought us boycotts, lost business, a sullied reputation, another court battle, and a betrayal of Arizona's heritage. Oh, yes, and it did nothing to make the border safer or reduce illegal immigration. So you might say that 1 year later, there's been a lot of morning after reflection and sense that maybe we made a mistake. We also got attacked by leaders throughout the world, like Mark Sertliff, who has said some nice things. But here's what Mark said shortly after 1070 was passed. We are different from Arizona here in Utah. We used to think the same was true. Utah colonized Arizona, but now they are disclaiming us as their errant progeny. We do things differently here, and here's the key. We want to show people we can follow the law and behave humanely. Promptly after Mark's statement, his good friend Al Sharpton immediately jumped on board and came to Arizona to show us the error of our ways. Okay, very quickly, indirect impacts. Economic impact, undoubted. The number, $388 million in casualties from the boycott that was directed at our convention trade. I'm not sure where that came from because it's an almost impossible number to determine. But suffice it to say, it's been big. It's been huge. We've been economically hurt, and the business community knows that. Our farming community has been particularly hammered by the lack of immigrant labor, the kind of thing that Utah wrestled with, Arizona considered a couple of years before, and decided not to try the pilot project with INS. The important thing about the conventions, I'm afraid, is not the ones that were canceled. It's the ones that just never put us on the books, that never consider. And once you're off the cycle, the rotation, you don't get back. And so it could be a permanent change to one of our most important industries. Our relationship with Mexico obviously has suffered. It doesn't help your business environment to have the Mexican Congress passing resolutions of censure on a regular basis. But what's even much more important is I met a year ago, less a month, with the produce shippers, the people that bring all of the nation's salad in the winter and most of the vegetables across the border. Arizona has been the port of entry of choice, by far the number one point of entry for approximately $22 billion industry. One of the shippers asked me, he said, does the legislature have any idea in passing 1070 what impact that has on our business? And I had to tell him, no, I think they do not. That hasn't crossed their mind. And, of course, all of southern Arizona is now threatening to secede from Arizona, calling itself Baja Arizona, perhaps as a reflection of that. But here's a $22 billion industry employing about 90,000 people in the state of Arizona, heavily impacted. And I understand, I feared this, and it may in fact be coming true, that Texas, our absolute arch nemesis after Utah, has now gained the first position in agricultural shipments. And I fear that that's something that we cannot reclaim because those changes tend to be permanent. We've had some good news. The National BCS Championship was held in Phoenix this year. Lots of people came. I can't say that they were deterred. Perhaps in part because of the federal judge's action deterring much of the enforcement of 1070. Mark Sertliff, however, is carrying this battle much further than anybody thinks reasonable. He's going after the BCS, not just Arizona, but the whole bowl concept. So Mark's fixing that one. Law enforcement, Mark made reference to it. He's absolutely right. Our sheriffs, our police chiefs, with only one or two exceptions, and those exceptions are very outspoken, Sheriff Joe Arpaio and now Sheriff Paul Babu, they have, the others say, this is a travesty for law enforcement. Not only does it divert resources if it were imposed, not only does it micromanage our police response, but it kills community policing. That thing where we depend upon the citizens to call in the leads. One-third of the state of Arizona is Latino. They are far less likely to call in when they see a crime in progress or suspicious activity. And there have been statements, I know, from proponents that 1070 is a frustrated way to fix a broken border and that it reflects a way of state law enforcement to help with border security. That's nonsense. And I think serious law enforcement has recognized it as such. People who, as a routine business practice, rape, torture, and murder are not going to be deterred by asking for their papers. I'm sorry. They've already committed enough felonies that if they're in the hands of law enforcement, they will be prosecuted, have been prosecuted, and this does not add one thing to our deterrence effect. Our image may be the worst casualty, and it's hard to figure out what an image effect is, but 1070 certainly had one. We've been called the New Birmingham, a center of intolerance and violence. Our own politicians have said we're a center of violence, and the beheadings are constant. Many people, parents of folks living in Arizona or going to school there, call their children and say, we're worried for your safety. We understand there are automatic weapons fire at all times of the day and night. Not true. In fact, along the Mexican border, we have one of the lowest violent crime rates in the nation. We're proud of that, but nobody notices that it's happening. So we have a bad reputation, and the worst of it probably is that Comedy Central has a special corner, a special affection for Arizona that has been reserved for our misstatements. Last, about the Ninth Circuit decision, I don't think it's had a big impact. However, it has drawn out the controversy. And I think here in a law center, we have to think about what the use of litigation. I want us to sound out in favor of the state of Utah, because I think the federal litigation, rather than working with the states, trying to find constructive solutions to some very real agony that the states are feeling budget-wise and crime-wise, they go to the courtroom. And as a result, the argument before the Ninth Circuit was on the 1st of November. The decision came down 2 weeks ago. An awful long time to wait. Now it will go to a trial on the merits. Another long delay. That will be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. Ultimately, they say to the Supreme Court, it puts an entirely different framework, and one that the proponents, Russell Pierce in particular, want to have happen. They've told us from the beginning, we don't want to try to enforce this. We want to fight it out in the courts. It did, however, give me my favorite quote, and I'll close with this. Judge Noonan, in the concurrence in the Ninth Circuit decision, said the following, and I think it's about time that we separated out the 26 pages of the district court opinion, the 80-plus pages of the Ninth Circuit opinion, and got to the heart of the matter. I think the judge said it very well. Federal foreign policy is a pleonism. A word that I'd never heard before. In Spanish, it's pleasmo. So that'll help clarify it for those of you who speak Spanish. What foreign policy can a federal nation have except a national policy? That 50 individual states or one individual state should have a foreign policy is absurdity too gross to be entertained. In matters affecting the intercourse of the federal nation with other nations, the federal nation must speak with one voice. That immigration policy is a subset of foreign policy follows from its subject, the admission, regulation, and control of foreigners within the United States. With the exception of the word pleonism, it is a really comprehensible idea of what we are talking about here, and I think we should focus on the bottom line. We don't have 50 foreign policies. We can and must have one in the United States, and this is a debate, frankly, about a challenge to that part of our federal system. I've got a lot more, but I'm going to stop talking.
Well, we'll get ahead. We'll get a chance to get back to it. So let me then turn to Tamar, because Tamar works with business interests across the country. And it certainly seems as though business and employer voices are becoming more and more active in this in these state-level debates. Talk to us about what role you see them playing. Is the involvement growing? Is it changing? And what are the other influential voices you're seeing? Give us some examples of differences in the politics around the country.
Great, Doris. Thank you so much. Thank you to all three organizational sponsors. It's really an honor to be here with this distinguished panel, Mark Shurtleff and Terry Goddard. So the short answer, Doris, is yes. Is it growing? Is it ever growing? For the past several years, four, maybe five, business has been emerging as a force and a voice in the immigration debate. Sometimes it's been slow, gradual emergence. Sometimes there have been bursts. Sometimes there have been steps back. But overall, the trajectory from 4 or 5 years ago is a steady upward trajectory. Just to give you a story to tell you how far we've come, this is not a state story, but about 5 years ago, we had a dinner here in D.C., a small behind-the-scenes private dinner, where we had a group of different kinds of business leaders to talk to policymakers. And there were executive vice presidents of major corporations that you all know, where you had lunch yesterday probably and where you've stayed in a hotel tomorrow. But there were also some small business owners in the group. And we went around the table asking people who they were and why they were there. And by far the most moving, powerful voice was a small business owner, a landscaper from California who had, 200 employees or something. And he started talking about how hard his immigrant workers worked, and how patriotic his immigrant workers were, and how they understood the value of family, and what a contribution they were to his business and his community. And so we had the idea, let's make a little TV spot about him. And so all the big companies around the table, you know, they didn't want to be anywhere near a TV spot or have their names in the media for being involved in immigration. But they were willing to pay a little bit to make a TV spot about this other guy. So we made a TV spot about this man. His name was Dave Penry from California. The ad ran. We ran it. We didn't know how ad campaigns worked, that they had to be bigger and national. But we ran this ad on all the Sunday morning shows in D.C. And sure enough, Dave Penry... The Wall Street Journal noted this and noted that here was a businessman speaking out, and this was so remarkable, they did a story about him. And Dave Penry, you know, he was an ornery, outspoken guy. That's why he was willing to do this. So in the Wall Street Journal, his quote, he said, how would you, and at the time I thought it was a terrible mistake and really distracting. I only now realize kind of how true it was. He said, how do you think it feels to be Bob Dole? How do you think it feels to be the first guy to talk about your erectile dysfunction? And he was comparing being the first business leader to speak out with being the first Bob Dole. And again, you know, at the time I was mortified. You know, I thought, oh my God, we did all this hard work. This is what it came to. But he was right. And the point is, he was right. So true story, it feels like a century ago, 5 years ago, Immigration Works has worked with business coalitions in 18 states in those 5 years. Got the scars all over to prove it. But let me fast forward to this year in the states to give you a sense of how far along things have come. And the point about business activity, and I think this is really the answer to your question, Doris, is how varied it is. How differently the groups, different groups act, what they focus on can be so different, when they do it, how they do it. The biggest divide, I think, is the decision about do you speak out publicly? Do you take a public stand, or do you work behind the scenes? Now, most of us as advocates, we're kind of formed to recognize and value speaking out publicly. And of course, you know, those who have business groups that have lifted up their voices in public this year have been, those are the ones we know about, those are the real heroes, those are the true victories. The Salt Lake Chamber, you know, took a huge lead in the Utah Compact. Arizona CEOs, I'm sure you all know, 60 CEOs signed a letter to the legislature saying, don't do this, 1070 was enough, the laws of past years are enough. That came together like a tornado, that Arizona letter. You know, it was literally a few chambers organized it. It came together in the space of 48 hours, and it actually worked. It was an important voice in saying to the legislators in Arizona that the state has gone far enough. We've become enough of a national pariah. No more. Let's take a time out. There have been other public stands that have gotten a little less attention. In Kansas, the business community came together and had a very public event, all sectors. In Indiana, big companies like Eli Lilly and Cummins. It's very rare to see big companies with big brand names take a stand. And, you know, these are fantastic. These are almost unbelievable breakthroughs, literally game-changing to see business come out front like this. But it's also true, and I mean, the truth is, I think we have to acknowledge that most people, business people, still prefer to work behind the scenes. They don't like to have their names in the media. They don't want to alienate the lawmakers who they are used to negotiating with and like to make deals with. And let's be honest, this is much more common. This is what happens in many more states than the states where we see these people bravely coming out publicly. And let's be fair, it can also be effective. It shouldn't be dismissed as just behind-the-scenes negotiation. I think business groups face a kind of agonizing choice. And I saw it most very vividly this year in a state that I won't name because they lost. Maybe you can guess. But, you know, the business community divided over, should we go on negotiating behind the scenes? You know, we think that's the only way we're going to get anything. We think that if we go out in public, we'll blow it with the lawmakers we need to convince. And they were convinced that lawmakers would shave a little here and shave a little there until the law became palatable. And then on the other hand, there was the group that was saying the lawmakers are never going to give in. You've got to muscle them, and you've got to go public and muscle them. But, you know, from D.C. and from the point of view of an advocate, that seems like an obvious decision. Sure, go for it, muscle them. But when you're in the state, it seems a little more complicated. And the truth is, I think the negotiators were right that these legislators weren't going to be muscled either. In that state, nothing worked. So my point is that negotiation can be an effective tactic for business. A combination of negotiation and speaking out can be a very effective tactic. Maybe backroom courage is a step on the way to public courage. It depends on the situation. And, you know, I think we've got to recognize help where it comes, wherever it comes. A second divide is the decision for business groups is what they're actually going to spend their energy fighting. Because, normally for business people, the first thing that's going to catch their attention is worksite enforcement, e-verify mandates, employer sanctions. That's what businesses are most focused on to begin with. Policing laws like SB 1070, it's taken a while for business to realize that perhaps that was of interest to them, too. And, you know, here, too, we've seen an evolution. And, again, the story comes out of Arizona. I think the Arizona business community would be the first to tell us they made a mistake on 1070. They were neutral on 1070 in the battle running up to it. And, I mean, they admitted and they owned the mistake. They were focused on the economic and the worksite parts of the law. They didn't foresee the boycotts. They didn't foresee the loss of workers. They didn't see the damage to the state reputation and economy. They learned their lesson, and business advocates in 49 other states learned the lesson. And this year, in every state where there has been a battle over a 1070-like measure, business has been involved in fighting it. And in fact, the truth is this year, as Doris pointed out, most of the 1070 copycats have been beaten back or tabled or taken off the table. And with them have often gone E-Verify mandates. So the main way that the business has defeated E-Verify mandates this year has been to get the public so concerned about the 1070 that the state has retreated totally. It hasn't worked everywhere, but that's been the main way things have worked this year. So third and last, just a word about strategy. You know, the third decision that business groups face, and this goes back to something Mark Shurtleff said, is do you just say no? Do you try to block the legislation, or do you come up with an alternative that scratches the itch of the lawmakers that want to crack down, but is something that business and the rest of the state can live with, so that lawmakers can keep their promises to voters that they crack down, but also minimize the damage to the state? And, you know, to many on the center-left, to many of us advocates, that second thing, come up with an alternative, you know, that's a little less bad, sounds like an unacceptable compromise. But the truth is that 99% of the time in these defensive battles, that's what works. Just saying no, just saying don't do anything, just saying enforcement no, states don't have any prerogative here, just citing the Constitution doesn't get us anywhere. The Arizona CEO letter that what happened in Arizona this year was the exception. Usually it is coming up with an alternative and fighting for that. The Utah outcome was an alternative. It includes a 1070-like policing measure, but it builds on it. There are many other examples. Virginia, Florida, we can go on and on. Usually it's about focusing, for example, on bad Apple employers who are deliberately breaking the law instead of going after all employers. Or in Florida this year, the choice is about mandate E-Verify, but also a possibility where businesses can look at driver's licenses. I mean, these sound like small things. They are shaving a little here, shaving a little there. But that's where we've had most success as in defense. This raises the question, you know, why do business coalitions or anyone in the state, why do they work to fix these bills? I mean, after all, if this is unconstitutional, why not let them pass kind of the worse the better, the easier to get knocked down in court? That sounds good sitting here on a podium in Washington if you live in the state or own a business in the state. You know, it's laughing. That's the point. It's a luxury you can't afford if you live in the states. You have to try to make the bill as palatable as possible. And again, I think it points to the hard choices these groups face. Going on the record, just saying no, you know, doing the brave, courageous thing, protesting, it's not usually that simple. Politics are the art of the possible, and these business groups in the state are working in a margin of the art of the possible. So the last word, you know, I just want to kind of take my hat off, really, to Utah. Utah has pulled something off really amazing. I mean, really, I think a historic turning point. We're going to look back and we're going to see Utah as a historic turning point. As I think Terry alluded to, they're not the only state that's been thinking about this. Immigration Works has been working with a variety of states over the past, I think, 3 years now. Arizona had a bill like this. Texas had a bill like this. Virginia considered a bill like this that never got introduced. In Washington State, there was a bill like this. And the point was to say enforcement only is not enough. Let's add a temporary worker component, whether it's immigrants already in the state or workers that we'll bring in for the future. We've got to recognize the economic need. And, you know, let's be honest here, too. These broader bills, they're probably not constitutional. Utah may or may not get a waiver. They may or may not ever be implemented and make much difference on the ground. But, and here are these two really important buts. The first but is the political breakthrough. Left and right, business, faith, law enforcement coming together, Republicans saying we got to be part of the solution again. You know, that's what's missing in Washington now. Republicans don't feel like they have to be part of the solution. So in these states, Republicans saying they have to be part of the solution, and everybody saying let's fix something rather than just crack down or just block something. And the second critical but is the message to Congress and to the rest of America, the message and the example that we've got to solve this, that it's a three-dimensional problem, and that the sky won't fall if we compromise and fix a little piece of it. The sky won't fall politically. So, you know, Utah is the historical achievement. It's the turning point. Now we've got to see more. And they can't just be, in my view, they can't just be compacts. The important thing about Utah, the compact is brilliant. The compact is amazing. But it's also that elected officials stepped up to the plate and actually passed something. I think I'll stop. You know, the good news is that business groups across the country are increasingly ready and willing to voice this message, to be part of this kind of fight. We've come a long way from, you know, Dave Penry. We certainly still have a long way to go, goodness knows. But I think creative, heroic experiments in the states are going to be a big part of driving us forward in the future.
Tamar, very, very helpful. Thank you. All right, Mark, historic turning point. Are you ready to be a historic turning point? Certainly Utah is being hailed as a new way forward. And you mentioned in your remarks that you're now going to go national, which is an interesting new development. Could you tell us what do you think is unique to Utah in this and what applies nationally? I mean, what do you see to be new obstacles, perhaps, in trying to take this national? And what level of confidence do you have that your law will actually ever be implemented in light of the Arizona litigation and the fact that this federal waiver doesn't exist?
Yeah. Well, thank you. And before I begin, I just wanted to remind you there was a note on the door to tweet the conference today. I've sent my tweet out, and you need to do the same. And use your tweets effectively by referring people back to some information. I included the www.migrationpolicy.org on my tweet. So just a little reminder. Use that technology. I mean, it's huge, especially as we start spreading the word to folks about what's going on. And especially the youth voice out there, I think, is very important to this debate. They seem to be much more open and receptive and, for some reason, more willing to see some important change. As far as Utah, the example there, and Tamar hit this on the head, and that is, you know, going back to the Declaration of Independence, where it says that government derives its just power, its just meaning, you know, equal, fair, its just power from the consent of the governed, that ultimately lawmakers are concerned. I mean, they want to be reelected so that they can use whatever influence they have or desire to serve to effect policy change. And so they are concerned. And so what we had to provide, obviously, without being too repetitive, was ability to tell them that there is support for you. There will be support. Now, we don't have elections for all those who voted until next year. I tell you, there's already a repeal 116, and there's all kinds of movements to oust the governor and for signing the bills. I was on the Diane Rehm show just recently, and there with the director of FAIR, and he on air guaranteed don't know if he's been to Utah. I guarantee that those who voted for this will be recalled or they'll lose in convention. I said, really? You're guaranteeing that?
You could prosecute them.
Could I? Okay, well, thank you for that idea. That may be...
Consumer fraud.
Thank you. Consumer fraud. Terry was always my mentor. I'm marking that down. And I may need outside counsel help in doing that.
I'm available.
All right. Actually, I'm quite confident now because you saw the change in the poll numbers as people got behind this group and they say, oh, yeah, they're actually speaking more for us. The compact ideals speak more for mainstream Utahns, Republican Utahns, even in the rest of red states where you have a large, really shrill right-wing Tea Party, 9-11s, 912ers, I guess they call themselves, this whole group that have come together with Eagle Forums and the other groups, they are still the minority. They don't sound like it, but they are. And that's what happened with this, and they started to take that confidence. And I'll tell you this, that may be Exhibit A in the lawsuit. We already had one senator in our state just resigned midterm. Probably one of the most conservative annual guest speaker at the Eagle Forum, et cetera. And he supported his daughter to replace him and a couple other extremely right-wing Republicans. One sitting legislator who was an enforcement-only guy all through the session. And they lost to a mainstream moderate Republican, Aaron Osmond. It didn't hurt that in Utah his name was Osmond, but I don't think that was the reason he won, literally, because at 2-1, to me, that's the first example. And they brought this issue up and really pushed it, the delegates, and it was delegates who picked the new replacement. I think that's a sign that there is cover, that you have to realize, and that's what this movement does, is getting people, once again, speaking out, and the majority of people. So yes, we did come up with some interesting results. One that we didn't talk about that Tamar made me think about was this giving the legislators something to say they're doing something. Enforcement is important. The rule of law does matter. But the role of law enforcement in our states, our sworn oath, is to enforce state laws. And as I mentioned before, there are many who are coming to our state undocumented and who stay there because they want to prey on the public, and they prey on first and foremost other unauthorized residents. And so we 2 years ago said, look, let us do something about this. We will create in my office what's called a secure criminal alien strike force of prosecutors teamed up with investigators, and we will focus just on major felony criminals who are also illegal aliens. They said, great, do it. We don't have any money to give you to do it. Well, we applied and got our money, and we're able to get enough to continue the strike force that is showing amazing success, and every legislator is up there proud of the success of our group. Well, this year, our money's run out, and we went to him and said, step up, Utah, now. If you like what we're doing, even though there are no building blocks in this budget, and even though you're cutting my office another 5% this year, you need to fund our secure strike force. And guess what? They did. And they're going back to their constituents saying, we're doing something about those who truly are the problem. And our very best support is the migrant community, and our confidential informants are primarily other, you know, undocumented aliens. Finally, as far as the national and what we do, you know, we do have a challenge. We did end up with an enforcement bill. There still was a need to do that. Fortunately, we convinced them to take out the reasonable suspicion. We made it major crimes. We tried to distinguish as much as we could. At the end of the day, what we ended up with, the sponsor, who was a Russell Pierce puppy dog, I guess I could call him, with all love and respect to Representative Sandstrom.
Running dog, actually.
Thank you, running dog. Okay. He is now being blasted by his own groups as having been a sellout and not doing so. So, but we still face potential challenge. I've met now twice with the Department of Justice, yesterday with Tony West. I mean, there's concern. They said, so you're asking us not to sue you? I said, yes, I'm asking. I'm hoping we don't need to be in litigation. I remind them in every aspect of our guest worker permit that everything says obtain federal waiver, obtain federal authority. I convinced them to put it off 2 years so that we could try and figure out some way, and maybe, if nothing else, encourage Congress to finally act or give some authority to do something about this. At the end of the day, there is no waiver, as you know. The first thing that they told me when I went in there, first thing when I went into the White House and others, was, you can't do that. I said, okay, we're trying to work through this. But what I wanted you to consider, and quite frankly, Doris Meisner was my inspiration on this. There's currently a memo that I was given, and I brought it up with Director Mayorga, and I didn't realize it was a leaked memo. He told me, is that the memo I haven't seen? I said, well, sorry, but it has some great points in here. You ought to take a look at it. But it talked a lot about what can be done currently under current policy for important purposes, and they listed keeping families together, economic growth, justice. How about that concept? You know, doing the right thing for the right reason. And then they cited, as they talk about things like deferral of action with regard to known unauthorized aliens and whether we're going to actually go after you and take action now or defer that. It's based on prosecutorial discretion. And they had a little footnote there from a 2000 memorandum from the director of INS, Doris Meisner, that talked about prosecutorial discretion and these issues. And so with justice and what we do, I mean, what we're offering there for companies is not, we're not saying we're going to make you somehow legal. What you do is still, if you hire one of these undocumented aliens pursuant to a Utah-issued guest worker permit, unless the federal government says they're going to exercise prosecutorial discretion or deferred action or, you know, they're not going to prosecute, you're still at risk. And so it's not going to work unless we actually have some kind of federal authority or some agreement. When they say, well, how do we do that? How can we can't just take a statement that we're not going to prosecute. I said, do you have the resources to go after every hundreds, thousands? How many companies are currently employing? You know, there's a lot of them. We know this. Do you have the resources to go after all of them? Confine up to 6 months CEOs, fine them $3,000 per or $5,000 per. Really? No, we don't have the resources to do that. We're very busy with our limited resources. USCIS, ICE, do you have the ability to go after 12 million or whatever the number is? No, we don't. What do you do? So I brought up an example from Arizona.
There you go again.
It has to do with polygamists.
This is our other border question.
I got present these. Company excluded.
Exactly. Attorney General Garner and I have worked on this issue. But the bottom line is there are tens of thousands of polygamists in the West. We don't have the resources in our state, Arizona doesn't, to go after and prosecute. And in Utah, it's a felony crime. I don't know in Arizona.
No, it's not a felony.
You see the problem. No, I love Arizona. I'm just kidding. We've worked well together. But my point was this. Tens of thousands. We only have 5,000 jail beds as it is in Utah. Are we going to build 4 new prisons? What do we do with 10,000 kids? Texas couldn't handle 500 when they took them from that compound. What do you do with? We don't have the resources to go after all of them, even though it's a felony crime. So we're going to focus, Terry Goddard and I and others, on those who are marrying little girls, the incest, the child abuse going on, the fraud in the education system and welfare. That's where we have to focus our limited resources. And that's what I'm asking. If we have people who are otherwise law-abiding citizens, whose kids are going to our schools and to our scout troops and are learning English and are, for all respects, Americans and who want to work, and we don't want them stealing people's Social Security numbers to work, let's bring them out of the darkness. And then, you know, they're not the troublemakers. We've done background screens on them. These aren't the problem people. And you, federal government, can then, until you take care of that issue, you can focus your limited resources on going after the bad. And that's where I'm coming from. Now, whether that will work or not, I don't know. We may be in litigation. We may not. But again, we are trying. And we are trying to work with federal government and to spur them on. And if nothing, at the end of the day, if it's just another resolution like we all pass, but this one on steroids, do something, federal government. Now is the time to act.
Yep. Could I comment on that for a minute?
Please.
Because I agree that Utah has done something very important, perhaps history-making. It's already been followed by Indiana, and I think a number of other states are looking at the compact principle. And what that does is it changes the message. And as somebody who got steamrollered by the message last summer, I have a lot of concern about the power of, for instance, Russell Pierce's statement, what part of illegal don't you understand? an incredibly powerful, simplistic, and effective political statement, and unopposed by what I believe is a strong majority or a potent majority of folks who say it's not that simple. There's a lot more to it. I think Utah has shown a very powerful searchlight. I think it's a little ironic, as we're talking about devolution, to talk about moving the compact into a national program. I thought we were working on states' rights here. But the flip side of the message is so important, because I totaled up in Arizona. We had the business community virtually unanimously against 1070. We had the faith community with very few exceptions, especially the evangelical faith community. And as Mark has pointed out, the Mormon Church strongly opposed to this kind of action. We had the labor unions, unlikely alliance here. We had almost all the newspapers. We had law enforcement. We had the minority community, brown, black, and red, in Arizona in a way I have never seen them unify before on a single issue. And yet in the election and in the legislative session, we got killed. And so I'm saying, by my calculation, that's 80% of the Arizona voters. What isn't being heard here? And what wasn't being heard was the articulation of principle that Mark has said so well today. What wasn't being heard was the crass self-interest of the business community and the fact that we were going to take a huge beating if we continued down this road in the convention trade, in our agricultural industry, in our hospitality industry. And what wasn't being heard was a variety of voices who basically said, you know, we've got a heritage here. One-third of our population is Latino. And before this was a country, they lived in the state of Arizona, before the United States was even formed. Sandra O'Connor has been very passionate about the fact that the border culture is an amazing culture based on faith and education and family, and it's being destroyed by some of the rhetoric that is being put out today. So if Utah does only one thing, and that's change the discussion, they will have accomplished something that's historic. And I think people who, Mark was straightforward to say it's not perfect. Of course it isn't. None of our legislative efforts are perfect. I find that every session they pass about 1,200 laws, and then the next session they amend and change about half of them. So it's a step in the right direction, however, and I think the idea of making it national is incredibly powerful and something that we ought to be part of.
Terry, let me ask you a follow-up to that in terms of the effects in Arizona, because you've made a very compelling case about a broad range of interests, from particularly, not only the economy of the state, the overall image, and the lasting effect that that has, but the sponsors of this legislation and the people that have been spearheading it, Russell Pierce, others, are claiming that it's a great success. So, you know, the issue is what are the benchmarks here? And success to them means, as has been vividly quoted, caravans of Latinos leaving the state. Well, here's a state that, as you say, has a large Latino population, much of it a legal population. Yes. And other minority groups. What do you say? You know, what does one say to that? Has that been happening? Is that overdrawn? Is all of the other things that you would consider to be negative not important in the face of this overriding commitment that sponsors of this kind of legislation have to changing the makeup of their states?
Well, the first casualty of this discussion has always been the truth and facts. And maybe that's not unique in American politics, but it certainly has been happening here. Some people, and Russell foremost among them, believe in creating revealed truth, that they come up, for instance, that 50% of the violent crime in Arizona is committed by illegal aliens. Not true. 50% of the prison population are illegal. Not true. But at various times that's been discussed. We have had an out-migration. And if you are one of the people who believes that that's a positive outcome, then you have made something happen. That I don't know how you estimate or precisely say what it is, but the paper has said as many as 200,000 people have departed the state because of the hostile climate, the enforcement, attrition by enforcement idea that's behind 1070. But it's not just 1070. It also was restrictions on registration. That was Proposition 200, and it's employer sanctions, which was just argued before the United States Supreme Court in December, and we're still waiting for a decision. So there has been a drumbeat, a progression of anti-immigrant activity, and some large number of people have left the state. The first casualty is a congressional district. I think it's without question that we would have had one more congressman in reapportionment if those folks were still in the state. So we have taken close aim. We're a gun rights state. We're very proud of that. So we've blown off our big toe in terms of a congressional seat that we might otherwise have taken. I think Mark's statement about the quarter is, I just can't not talk about that for a second. Utah's mission is the golden spike and the unity that comes from it. Arizona's statement, and we're very proud of this, are the saguaro and the Grand Canyon, two items that are never seen together. And therefore, we have the dichotomy. Utah has the joining. Maybe that's our biggest difference. But there have been results. Clearly, there have been results. But first, I think what we need in this discussion is a very much better access to real information. I'd like to know how many people have left. I'd like to know how many Mexican dollars are not coming into the state. I'd like to know what's happening to the agricultural trade. I'd like to know how many people are coming across illegally today and how many are being deterred. I mean, ICE gives us partial looks, but nothing that advocates and opponents of 1070, I think, would have to agree. We don't have anything like the kind of data bank that we need to have an intelligent discussion about the real impacts of these legislations.
Can I just add an exclamation point on that? Because, yeah, it was more than in Utah, just, it was compact and everybody joined it. We had to start doing conferences like this and bringing an expert, and there was, as far as the truth being told, in particular, initially they were giving all the crime, the alleged crime statistics, and how much of our prison population is made up of illegal aliens and Latinos. So we had we asked a BYU law professor who did beginning way last fall, quickly put together a very in-depth study of every jail and the state and also the state prison system and the populations, very thorough, that we were able to then bring out, make public, to show the truth was that it mirrored, and actually in many cases the number of Latinos committing crimes and being incarcerated were substantially less than their percentage of the population. That was the truth. And once the truth, people start hearing that, they hear the opposite to what the loud voices are saying, and that's very important. You're right.
And in law enforcement, there's a perception, and it has been, I think, in the mainstream today, that the illegal population, the workers and the folks in our communities, are the same as the cartels, who are the organized criminals bringing people and drugs into the United States. As a law enforcement officer, I know that's not true, but it has been very difficult to get through the popular perception that they're one and the same, and you fight the cartels by getting rid of the illegals.
At the end of the day, you don't get rid of it by the enforcement. What we have to do, and what we tried to do, is to incentivize legal migration, and as opposed to just thinking that somehow we can shut down through enforcement only the illegal migration.
I just want to add one note.
Pull your mic up.
Yeah, I want to add one note that Mark kind of reminds me of, but that we haven't talked about too much, which is public opinion. And I think one of the very interesting things about the devolution of the debate to the states is the way it lets us get at the public in a different way. Because it's true that, when you poll on 1070-like legislation, it's very popular. 60% of the public, no matter basically where you ask, says they like it. And, I think it's because they don't quite understand what it is. They think, finally someone is doing something. That's what most polls, when you probe a little deeper, that's what they're saying. And you often see polls where people ask, well, are you for 1070? Are you for comprehensive? And you get kind of equal percentages. So it's not exactly the same people, but big overlap, 64 1070-like law and 64 comprehensive. So, it goes back to what we've always known about the public, which is that there's a small minority, maybe it's 15-20%, maybe 25 some places, that are just really anti-immigrant. And then there's another small minority, 15-20%, that gets it and, understands where the country needs to go. And then there's 60% in the middle that aren't sure and that are susceptible to the arguments of, we've got to crack down, we've got to do something about this, maybe we should even drive them out, but are also susceptible to the arguments of principle and pragmatism. And the beauty, I think, one of the beauties of taken the debate to the states is that I think you can get at that 60% in many ways more effectively than you can when it's just on TV. And it's because people like Mark Shurtleff and Terry Goddard and business people and centrist people and center and left and faith and people in communities trust come out and say, well, the only way to handle this there are other ways to handle this, and it's the only way to handle it is not just to crack down and not just to kid ourselves so we can drive them out. So, I think the one of the beauties of the devolution, one of the good sides of the devolution that we're not talking about, is the way it makes it possible to have a different kind of more local debate with trusted local messengers.
Okay, I'm going to open the floor now because we have a few minutes left and lots of interesting topics on the table. So let's raise hands, and I'll point, and then we'll get a mic to you as quickly as we can. And when it does come to you, please tell us who you are and an affiliation if you have one.
Yeah. Well, just a comment to Mr. Goddard. What you ended up doing is creating...
Give us your name.
Reverend Ippolito from St. Brendan's Church, Ocean Isle Beach, North Carolina.
Okay, Mike.
And what you created was a climate fair. I had a woman in my church who was wanting to go visit her mother in California. She's not legal. And I arranged a plane ticket for her to change plans in U.S. Airways in Phoenix. There is no way in hell was she going to even... I said, all you need to do is just change planes there. No way was she ever even going to even change planes in Phoenix. It was just not even possible.
Yeah, we hear a lot of that. The mythology, if we get nothing else today, Mark Shurtleff and my joint plea, not just for principle, but for fact, is hopefully because in that case, they're not going to get arrested in the airport. But, I know a lot of people believe it.
Right here on the aisle.
Hi. It's a little loud. Eliza Gray with the New Republic. Mr. Shurtleff, you mentioned that you talked about prosecutorial discretion really quickly, and I wanted to just ask the panel, if you think, why is it that DHS using prosecutorial discretion would help you? What are the positive benefits for the states if DHS were to make administrative changes? Is the first question, and I guess the second question is, do you think that that's the best action that the White House could take at this juncture?
Let's turn to you, Terry, because you've spoken a little bit about it.
Well, I've made the same plea to Justice not to sue Arizona when and I had substantially less grounds than Mark does. I mean, they have learned from the Arizona precedent. They've read the district court opinion. They've tried to thread the needle. Whether they've done it perfectly or not, I don't know. But the bottom line is we have a crisis. We have, I hope it's clear, a group of people who want to send a message to Washington, want to see something happen. It's absolutely true what Tamar said, that there's in Arizona, you might not think this, but we have the same breakdown where people are for 1070 and for comprehensive immigration reform. Two concepts which you probably can't really comfortably hold in the same pot. But nonetheless, that's how people feel, and they're very frustrated, both at the failures to revise the visa system so that businesses' needs are actually reflected in the kind of legal permits that we allow into the country, and at what's perceived as other federal failures. So what I would say is, absent a congressional action, which would be a nice thing right now, and if we could work together in a bipartisan way to make that happen, that would be number one. Our business community tried to do it in Arizona last summer. They were weak and ineffective, but they were unanimous in saying that's what we need to rescue the Arizona economy. But absent that, work with Utah. Let's look at the guest worker program and try to make it work within the federal guidelines. Nobody's used medical marijuana yet as an example of selective enforcement. But if they were to go after the federal law in California and now in Arizona, who's just approved it, obviously a whole lot of people are now offenders. But they're not going to do that. So it seems to me that this is a time to stay the enforcement and try to find a practical solution that's going to work, perhaps as a prototype for national action, having miserably failed to achieve national action.
And what I would say about the administration, less about DHS and the administration generally, is they're kind of caught between two political forces. One is obviously, you know, the president's running for re-election. Latino voters are hugely important. He's going to want to do the right thing by Utah for that reason. You know, he's not going to be the one to say, well, you pass this great law, we're going to say no. On the other hand, the federal government's very invested in preemption as an argument ultimately this is a federal matter. Ultimately, federal government should make the law. Ultimately, you know, that's what's in the Constitution, and that's what we hope the court will rule. You know, the problem is the short term. So I think the administration is caught between their need to defend preemption as an absolute and wanting to do the right thing politically for Latinos, and I don't know how they'll come out.
We're talking about principle here, too, I hope, and the right to preempt implies the right to act. And why in the world you can say, well, you're preempted, but we're not going to do anything either. I think that is a fool's argument and one that we'll lose.
And it reminds me of, with all due respect, Chairman of the House Judiciary, Lamar Smith, who, quite frankly, I've worked with him on a number of law enforcement issues and have testified in committees in the past on law enforcement issues. But for him to write a 6-page letter to Justice demanding that they sue the state of Utah, how dare they get involved in this federal issue, for him to say that when he's done nothing to resolve this issue where it is their authority. I mean, as soon as he came out with that comment, I remembered with time when I bought my little girl Danielle a sandbox. It was in a big turtle. And she came in on her birthday and said, Tommy's playing in my sandbox. And I'm like, well, it's okay. There's room for both of you. She goes, well, I wasn't playing in it. But he is.
As preemptive.
What's he doing? He's building a little castle. I said, well, what were you doing? Well, it's my sandbox. Get him out of it, you know? And I said, what were you going to do? And she said, I was going to build a castle with a really high wall and a moat with piranhas. No, she didn't actually. I made that part up. But no, but it's true. So there is huge pressure on him. And immediately, you know, I guess that's why when DOJ heard I was here for this conference yesterday, they asked me to stop by.
Was that in one of the public rooms? Or
a discussion. The first thing they said, now, you're Republican, because you're suing us on Affordable Care Act. You're one of those Republicans that are suing us, claiming that we're inserting ourselves in a state issue with health care, and now you're asking us not to sue you when you're inserting yourself in a federal issue. We don't get it. I said, I know. I'm a little confused too, but
a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little mind.
But I think that the only way that a deferred action for ICE, prosecutorial discretion for DOJ going after companies hiring illegal aliens, the only way that works is if you just have to say, look, this is the reality that we're facing here. It's the reality of the situation. We do not have the resources. Our hands are full. We're very busy. Our limited resources to go after these who are causing the major problem. In the meantime, while states are trying to have, we're gonna let the states where the problems are existing, where they have economic issues, where they need the employment, where they have these people living in their communities and participating or not fully within the community, as part of the community. We need to let that happen. And that's, you know, again, wishful thinking most likely on my part, but it's something we're trying.
Okay, Ben.
Ben Johnson, American Immigration Council. So the other refrain in Congress's excuse for not acting is, you know, we have to secure the border first. So what does that mean? What should that mean? What's the connectedness of that to the immigration issue? Just if you could sort of peel back the layers of that onion.
Well, I think Arizona should start with that.
Well, as somebody who's worked, to that purpose, let me say that the big problem with the secure the border debate is nobody has ever defined what that means, not the administration and not the McCains of the world who keep using it as the foil for any other action. And so I would be the pleader for let's be clear. It's one of the most dynamic, if not the most dynamic, borders in the world. It has huge trade action. It has huge tourist action. It has, you know, the idea of sealing the border, I hope, is absurd. So you have to work with a dynamic economic reality. And that's number one. Second, you have to work with a culture that's many centuries old. As Sandra O'Connor has said, it's a rich culture, and it goes back to Spanish and Native American roots, which way predate the United States of America. Let's respect that, too, because I think it's an important part of what we're dealing with. And let's get the debate about real law enforcement issues, please. I've been pleading with the federal government to take action at the U.S. Treasury to stop the illegal flow of funds into Mexico. They could do that much better than they're doing it today. The U.S. Treasury is uninvolved in the fight. ICE is involved, Border Patrol is involved, Justice is involved, but one other major administration entity is not. And I think we have to ask why not and get serious about comprehensive attacks on the cartels. Frankly, I think that if we make as part of our national goal not building a fence, which we know will be evaded 20 different ways, you can't build an effective fence against a community that has the finest hard rock miners in the world. It won't work. The honeycomb, the city of Nogales and all the other border communities with underground tunnels, just for starters, and now ultralight aircraft are bringing the drugs apart. They make a mockery of such a wall that exists today. But let's go after Chapo Guzman. He's the head of the Sinaloa cartel. His name is in Business Week. He's one of Fortune's designated most wealthy billionaires in the world. If they can get him and find a picture, why can't our law enforcement officials? So I would like the administration to pick that as a singular target and say we will have succeeded in making the border more secure when Chapo is behind bars and all the people that work in his hierarchy. That's what we're fighting on the border. That's what's making mincemeat of our border protections. They can run ragged any very effective border. We've greatly increased the Border Patrol presence, but the cartels are a whole lot better than that.
Any other comments on border security?
Well, just this, the point that we haven't even brought the this fact up, that with all the anti-Latino tenor of this whole anti-immigration debate, I mean, with that, it's driving a greater wedge, and it makes our biggest neighbor to the south, Mexico, wonder about whether they should cooperate. When in truth, the only way we really ever solve this issue, which is an economic issue, and people who need jobs and need work, not necessarily because they want to become Americans, but because they need the help, is to help Mexico succeed. And for people to say, we don't want their third world crime and their third world this and that, when 35,000 Mexicans are dead in this war to feed our insatiable appetite for drugs, using our guns, going south across the border. And this is a place where Terry Goddard has been a true leader. And we, for years, have been working through MOUs with our colleague, Attorneys General, Procuradores Generales in the Estados de Mexico, that we are signing these agreements. We have now, Terry and I and other Western Attorneys General, have cross-trained 15,000 Mexican police officers and prosecutors as they're trying to reform and to do better. We need to help their economy to succeed. We need to work with them, and the president of Mexico said, if we see that help, if we see that cooperation instead of this constant degradation of us and our values and our cultures and constantly throw up the wall, if we can work cooperatively, we can do more on our side of the border. As you do more to keep out the guns coming south, we'll do more to keep out the drugs and the people from coming across. We can work cooperatively, and that's been left out of this equation, but it can be done between states. Speaking of devolution.
And it is happening, and in this prestigious law center, I hope people will concentrate on the change that Mexico is doing to their entire criminal justice system. It's not a small thing. And the fact that we've trained this number of prosecutors, and the states have done it, it's not been the federal government, and we have stepped up, and now we're training judges. So the next, they are going to have, Mexico, as you probably know, has a 1% conviction rate in capital and major crimes. That's got to change if we're going to be successful in the war against drugs south of the border. And we need to have public trials. We need to have a process of direct confrontation. That does not exist today, but Mexico's making the change, and it takes a lot of guts, a lot of determination, and a lot of help from those of us who I think know how to do it.
And I know we're out of time, but very quickly, one of my bills we haven't talked about, the one that I wrote as part of our comprehensive reform, was to create a memorandum of understanding between Utah and Nuevo León, Monterey, which consulate there issues more H-2 visas than anywhere else in the world, to work collaboratively toward creating a better pipeline and then a study for guest worker permits and the limits and the time frames on how long you have to wait. And that's something else that we're doing to show that we're working cooperatively within federal rules and federal guidelines. House Bill 466 is another part of our comprehensive reform.
Okay, well, I don't think we could have gotten a stronger start to this day, nor could we have had a better panel. Thank all of our guests very much. We'll take a break and see you back here at 10:45. Thank you so much.
For more information, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/U.S. immigration.